The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you. And today, the return of Sarah Byrne Rickman to the program. She has completed her trilogy about the Wasp. And the latest book is called Wasp of the Fairy Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds, an amazing story about over 1,000 women who ferried airplanes around the United States during World War II. We'll be talking to Sarah Byrne Rickman about it coming up following the news. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today I'd like to welcome back to the program Sarah Byrne Rickman. She joins us by telephone from Texas Woman's University in Denton, Texas, and her book Wasp of the Fairy Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds, came out recently and is the third book in her trilogy about Wasp. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you, Vic. It's good to be back.
How long has it been, Sarah? It's been, what, 15 years since we had you on?
I was on either late 2001 or early 2002, so okay. Yes, right at 15 years. That was book number one. This is book number seven.
And they've all been about WASP?
Yes.
Okay. For some reason, I read something somewhere that said it was a trilogy. Maybe that's just your press that said that.
No, the trilogy began with The Originals, which is what you interviewed me about 15 years ago.
Okay.
It was the story of the original WAFs, the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron. They were the first 28, an elite squadron of very experienced women pilots that were the first ones hired by the Army Air Forces to fly, to ferry aircraft for the Air Transport Command Ferrying Division. What I've done now, the second book of the trilogy, it wasn't a trilogy when I started. I just wrote the originals, and then I began to find out I hadn't told quite the whole story. So the second book was the biography of Nancy Harkness Love, called Nancy Love and the Wasp Ferry Pilots of World War II. She was the commander, the leader, the founder, along with her superior, Colonel William H. Tunner. They were the founders of the WAFs, the original WAFs. Mm-hmm. And the third book, The Wasp of the Ferry Command, tells the rest of the story,
okay,
which is how the group went from 28 to 303.
So it is technically a trilogy.
It is a trilogy. The
okay.
other books, the other four books are two biographies and two novels.
Gotcha. My guest is Sarah Byrne Rickman. Sarah, I know we have listeners out there who have never heard of WASP. Let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
What was WASP?
Women Air Force Service Pilots. Air Force is one word, spells out WASP. And they are collectively the 1,102 women who flew for the United States Army Air Forces during World War II. And it was then the Air Forces. This is before the U.S. Air Force was founded came about in 1947. And these were the women, 1,102 of them total. And I can explain as little or as much as you want about where they all came from, but that they are the WASP. We're not talking, well, some of them were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, but certainly far from all of them. So that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the women Air Force service pilots.
And they have been in the news here recently.
Yes.
A very dramatic occasion at Arlington National Cemetery.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that and then circle back into your current book. Let's talk about what happened and why this was such a big deal.
Well, what happened was a woman, one of the WASPs, by the name of Elaine Danforth Harmon, who was in the next, well, I'll have to explain classes later, but she was one of the later WASPs to actually join the group. But Elaine had been very, very active. She lived in Silver Springs, Maryland, and was active when the WASPs were looking to get their official militarization in 1977. They were not militarized during the war. There was a big move on to militarize them. General Hap Arnold, the commander of the Air Forces, wanted them militarized, but Congress turned it down. And the reasons were, by the time they tried to militarize the WASP in 1944, the war had actually turned, and we were winning World War II. We had not been early on. So all of a sudden, everyone is looking to, well, you know, the war is going to be over. We're winning. And we've got these women flying airplanes. We've got these women in the munitions factories. Women have taken over a lot of jobs to relieve men to go to fight the war. And this was the turning point. The war was going to be over. Everybody wanted to go back to normal. So the effort to militarize these women who were actually doing military, they were civilians, civil servants, doing what was the equivalent of military work, and they had ranking of officers, though they were not called. They were not officers commissioned, but they had the ranking of officers. And where they could have been militarized had all this started in 1943, by 44, it was too late, and the move was, we've got enough men, we don't need these women doing these jobs. It's too costly to militarize them. So Congress voted it down in June of 1944. In 1977, the WASP had put together a movement over a number of years to get that militarization. They wanted to be official veterans, to have some veterans benefits. Now, they missed out on a lot of them, but there were still things, particularly the hospitalization, the medical, that they could be heirs to. So the fight began all over again in 1977 for the militarization of the 1,102 women who were considered WASP. That did pass. There's two or three books that are written that have good descriptions of it. I don't go into it in the as thoroughly as some of the others do. One of the best is Those Wonderful Women in Their Flying Machines by Sally Van Wagenen and Kyle, who was the niece of one of the WASPs. Mm. Hers is the first book that I know of that came out, and it was one of my Bibles when I was writing the originals. She tells rather detailed the story of that militarization. Well, Elaine was one of the women working on that in Washington. There were several WASPs. Most of them lived in the area, and they were working towards this militarization. They got it. They got the help from two very prominent men, Colonel Bruce Arnold, the son of General Hap Arnold. Hap Arnold was long gone by then, but his son Bruce picked up the banner and decided he was going to get the WASP militarized, which was his father's wish. And Senator Barry Goldwater. Goldwater had flown with the women of the Ferry Command in 1943 and 1944. And he knew a lot of these gals, and he knew what they had done and how good they were. And the two of them were the big names pushing for the militarization in 1977. Okay, after that, it was slow to happen, but in 2002, one of the daughters of one of the WASPs who had died put out an effort to get her mother buried or inurned, the ashes inurned, and I'm not sure whether this particular wasp is inurned or buried, doesn't matter. But this daughter was able to get her mother into Arlington, and that changed things. And between 2002 and early 2015, 11 to 13 to 14 wasps, no more than that, were buried in Arlington. And in March of 2015, the acting Secretary of the Army said, "No, this is not right. It's on a technicality." He stopped it. Elaine Harmon died the following month, April of 2015. It was her wish to be buried in Arlington. She had, being a Washington area resident, had attended all of the funerals of her fellow WASP that had been held at Arlington, and this meant something to Elaine. So in April or May a year ago, 2015, when her family started to make arrangements, they were told no, that WASP would no longer be allowed there. Well, basically, you know, excuse me, you know the rest of the story. The Harmon family, joined by, I've forgotten how many petitioners, the women in Congress picked up the banner this time, and they carried it through to senators and to congresswomen, pushed for this bill, got the women in the media behind them. They got men and women all over the country behind them. The men I know who know about the WASP were, if anything, more rabid than the women. The correct bill was passed back in the spring. The president signed it in May, and now Elaine has been laid to rest in Arlington as per her wish, and the whole world knows about it. It's amazing. It shows the power of getting something done if you really, really feel strongly, and these people felt strongly. The thing was, the Army, who runs Arlington, felt that they were running out of room. Well, technically they are, but we were talking by this time, there are currently 97 WASP remaining that we pretty well have a track on who's still alive. And, you know, if all 97 of them wanted in, which they don't, because most of them have said, no, I'm going with my family wherever I live. But even if those 97 wanted in, that's a drop in the bucket to what is left in Arlington. So it became, I guess you would say, a moot point once Congress passed it and the president signed it. And Elaine was laid to rest a week ago yesterday, September 7th, at Arlington. Huge attendance. I was planning to go, and my schedule changed on me. I couldn't go, but many, many, many notables and people who know the WASP, and five or six of the WASP themselves were there. The youngest WASP is now 92. They don't travel real, real well, but there were, as I say, four or five of them there. There's several who still are able to travel, and a number of them were there. So it's a done deal. It's marvelous, and the whole world knows about it. So Elaine is up there smiling somewhere. Mm.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Sarah Byrne Rickman. Her book is WASP of the Fairy Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds. The Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to have on the program today Sarah Byrne Rickman, her book WASP of the Fairy Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds. This is a story of these 1,102 women who were WASP. It's also the story of those first two women, those last two women. These two women, one of whom you've devoted a whole book to, they mm-hmm. are such key players in this story. Tell us about these two women.
Colonel William H. Tunner of the Air Transport Command Ferrying Division needed ferry pilots very badly in the spring of 1942. And he found out that there was this woman who was working at one of the local air bases who might have an answer to that. So he got to know her, And yes, she did have an answer. And her answer was she was able to recruit 28 very highly experienced women pilots who could actually start ferrying the small Army aircraft kind of without extra training. And so he put her to work, said, find them for me, and let's see what we can do. So that was the beginning of it. Now, Nancy was actually appointed September 10th, 1942. At the same time, Jackie Cochran, who was a famous racing pilot and also had her own cosmetic company, and I remember Jackie Cochran Cosmetics, and most of the older women around will remember Jackie Cochran, mm-hmm. or Jacqueline Cochran Cosmetics. She also had an idea of training young women who had a few hours of airplane experience, maybe a pilot's license, a few more hours, of training them to fly the Army way and to utilize them in ferrying and in other jobs. She called them the dishwashing jobs of the Army, and that's not to denigrate them so much as to say they were the things the men really didn't want to do. The guys had heroism and combat and all this on their minds, and they wanted to be fighter and bomber pilots and all that. Well, there was a lot of other flying that needed to be done, and they were in many ways kind of small jobs, and the women who ended up taking them just loved to fly. That is the common thread through all of these women, is they just wanted to fly, and this was a way to do it and serve their country. So she got a, through Hap Arnold, she was able to get a women's detachment to learn to fly the Army way. It was first based in Houston, Texas, and then later in Sweetwater, Texas, which is really where it's famous for having been done in Sweetwater. And through that, the Army trained 1,074 women. That's how many graduated with their wings from this facility and went on to fly with the WASP. If you add that to the 28 original WAFs, that's where you get your 1,102.
And these two women had this rivalry.
Yes, they did. They were complete opposites. Nancy Love was, Jackie, we kind of called her those society dames, Nancy, and some of the wealthy women who had the money to learn to fly back when nobody else was learning to fly back in the 30s. It was a misnomer in many ways, but yeah, Nancy came from a kind of a privileged family and went to one of the Eastern schools. She went to Vassar, and it was a worse rivalry in the newspaper than it was actually, though they did not like each other. That's a fact. They did not like each other. Cochran came up the hard way from down in Florida, and her story was kind of a tobacco road kind of thing. She was a little girl who went to work really early. She started working at age 8 or 9 in a beauty parlor, just doing the dishwashing kind of jobs. And ended up becoming a hairdresser, a very famous one. She went to New York. She went to work for, I think it was Charles of the Ritz. Antoine. I believe that was the one she actually went to work for. Met a wealthy man who divorced his first wife and married her, and therefore became a very wealthy woman. And decided that what she wanted to do when we went to war was to use her piloting skills to organize other young women pilots who would then fly for the Army doing a variety of jobs. They were opposite temperament. Jackie wanted to command. She would have liked to have been on par with the WACs and the WAVES, but the WASP were far smaller than those groups. Those groups had thousands. The WASP had 1,100. Nancy cared nothing about command, but she had the inside track. She got along well with the men who were in charge. She knew how to get things done. The women adored her and followed her. And so she was able to lead by example. She flew most of the airplanes first in order to prove that an average woman, Nancy was like maybe 5'6", average woman. She wasn't big, strong gal. She wasn't tiny. But she went out to prove that, you know, an average woman could learn to fly these machines, and if you had the right stuff, and these gals had to have the right stuff. I will tell you, to be a pilot, you got to have a little something extra, or want to have a little something extra. Mm-hmm. And she had it, and they had it. Cochran wanted to command from the beginning. Again, she had founded a cosmetics company. She had an empire that she had built herself. She wanted to build an empire of a command. So two opposite approaches to what they wanted to do with the women who followed them in the war.
And if you read the book, WASP of the Fairey Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds by Sarah Byrne Rickman, you'll discover that she wanted to be in command, but she also was a big reason that they weren't militarized when they could been. And that's all explained in the book. And the book is filled with photos and all kinds of accounts by these women of flying. And I think we probably need to explain to our listeners what this ferrying is all about. What were they doing? And there was a couple of different things that they did in the ferrying. They had to kind of move up and advance their skills, and it got really exciting by the middle of the war.
Oh, yeah. It really did. You want me to enlarge on that at this point?
Please do, yes.
Okay. All right, ferrying. That means that the pilot is taking the airplane and delivering it from one place to another. He or she is not ferrying passengers. Yeah, might have a passenger in the back if it was a bigger plane, but that was not the point. These were not passenger planes. They were not. They were not doing bombing runs. They were not. They were literally being taken, the airplane, from quite often the factory to, in the earlier days, the WASP were flying the smaller trainer planes from the factories to the training bases, most of which were down south, an awful lot of them in Texas. But all across the south, the weather was better. They had longer flying season. So that's where we were training the young men who were going to go over and fight the war in the Atlantic and the Pacific. So they were ferrying primarily the primary trainer to begin with. That was the trainer that all the pilots start in, male and female. They flew the PTs, the primary trainers. Then came the basic trainers, and then the advanced trainers. And they increased in size and technology. I've lost the word. But they started with these small primary trainer aircraft. That was the job of the first WAFs of the first 28, was to ferry trainer planes that were desperately needed at the bases to train cadets. That was in late 42 and throughout most of 43. But as the war began to change and move, we moved out of training more male pilots to go to combat. We were very successful in training the men to go take these jobs. And we reached a point where, I mentioned earlier, we began to win the war as opposed to losing it. We were not aware of this. I've heard people talk about, you know, in reading the newspapers and all during the war, the general populace really was not that aware of what was going on. But what they tell us now in the books is that first year, we were in bad shape after Pearl Harbor, but they tried to cover it up with obvious reasons. But as the war moved on, we began to hit the kind of winning trail. And that is when the manufacturer of the combat aircraft took over and more of those were being built, and fewer trainers. So the women who were ferrying the aircraft, all of a sudden, they did not need to ferry trainers anymore. They needed, in order to be of use to the Army, they needed to transition, is the terminology, to transition up so that they could fly these more powerful, higher speed, complex airplanes, primarily the pursuit aircraft, and that's what they called fighters in those days. Mm-hmm. And these are, anybody who remembers any World War II history, the P-51 was the tops, the fastest, the sexy plane. Uh-huh. P-47 was the biggest. P-39, P-40, and P-63, those are all single engine. And then there were the P-38 twin engines and the P-61, which came along really right at the end of the war, which was only about five WASP ever got to fly that one. It came along so late. It carried the first radar. Mm-hmm. But in order to fly those pursuit planes, they had to have, instead of 35 to 50 hours, which is what they needed to enter training, a pilot's license and a little bit more experience is what it amounted to. The ferrying division, to have a man or woman learn to ferry a pursuit aircraft needed 500 hours. So that meant that these WASP had to have been in the WASP long enough and a good enough pilot to move up rather quickly, transition up, to accrue 500 hours. This is the main reason why more of them did not get into ferrying pursuits. They simply did not have time to accrue 500-plus hours, plus be checked out in a Class 3 airplane, which is like a C-47 or a B-25, a twin-engine, middle-range, middle-weight aircraft. That's what they needed to go to pursuit school. And pursuit school opened for men and women December 1st, 1943. Mm-hmm. That's when they realized they needed to train a lot of men and a few of these women, as many women as could qualify. They needed to train them to ferry these pursuit aircraft so that they could pick these aircraft up at the factory and take them to the docks. If the plane was going to the European theater, then they were flown to Newark, New Jersey, and landed at the docks there where they were put on Liberty ships to be shipped to England. If the plane was going to the Pacific, it went to San Diego or I'm blank for a minute. There were two ports out there, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Right.
They were taken from the factory to these ports of embarkation where they were put aboard Liberty ships to be shipped abroad. That became the primary job of the WASP of the ferry command. Now, that only involved, there were 303 women who were considered ferry command pilots, women ferry command pilots. Of that, 134 qualified to ferry the pursuit aircraft. And they did that across between December 1st, 1943, and October 15th, 1944. That is how long women were attending pursuit school. And what happened, maybe you don't want me to go on at that point, because then another switch comes.
Actually, we have to take a break, and we have so much ground to cover here. My guest is Sarah Byrne Rickman. Her book is WASP of the Ferry Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds. She joins us on the telephone today from the campus of Texas Woman's University, which has a huge archive of WASP material. And wow, this is quite a story, and so dangerous. A number of them died, and we're going to talk about that right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Sarah Byrne Rickman. Her book is WASP of the Ferry Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds. And, oh, what a risky job. Let's talk about these planes these women had to fly back that were barely flyable, and some of the other hazards they endured, weren't they also involved in target practice?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Okay. Now, that is when you move out of the ferry command and into the rest of the jobs that the WASP did. One of the first jobs other than ferrying that the WASP were taken to try was towing targets. And initially, 25 of them were sent in the summer of 43, were sent to Camp Davis, North Carolina, to learn to tow gunnery targets. Now, down at that point, they were flying a target sleeve about, I always get this wrong, 30 meters. I said 30 feet, and somebody said, no, that's too close. I think it's 30 meters behind the plane. They would tow this target sleeve, and these young raw recruits, 18-year-old kids on the beach, were firing at the targets these ladies were towing, and men did this too. It wasn't just the women. But that is what 25 of the earlier WASP learned to do, was to tow these gunnery targets. And later that grew into from airplane to airplane, in other words, firing off of, say, a B-17, firing at a target sleeve pulled by a B-26, something like that. So it was air-to-air. But it was target practice, and if the guys didn't lead the target well, they could end up putting some lead into the tail of an airplane, and that did happen on occasions.
So these women are flying along, and they're being shot at, literally.
Yes.
The thing they're towing is the target.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, my. And then they had these planes that were essentially wrecks that were being sent back to the scrapyard. But these women had to ferry them back to where they were supposed to go. And a lot, you have these stories in here where these women are talking about these crazy things. They should have been flying these at all.
That's right. That's right. The Army wanted them taken to a specific, like, dump or boneyard. They called it the boneyard, where they were putting the shot-up planes that really were no longer flyable, but... Someone said, why can't you just put them on a truck and take them? Well, it's easier to fly it there and then junk it. But somebody had to fly it. And a lot of the women, and they had to be checked out in that airplane. In other words, if they were flying a twin-engine attack plane, like the A-20, they had to be pretty high up and skilled and been checked out in flying something like that. But it was not a brand-new airplane that was shiny and ready to go. It had been shot up. There were things that didn't work. And they were taking planes like that to the boneyard.
Hmm.
And, the ones that I put in the book came out of oral histories that really were some of the more harried ones. I'm trying to remember. I don't think... that any of the 38 who died were ferrying, I call them redliners. I'm not sure if that's, the planes that were going to the boneyard had a red line drawn through them, if I'm not mistaken, and I think I referred to them as redliners. But they were junk airplanes, and all of these gals had one or two that were really bad.
Huh.
I know one of the gals was ferrying one of those and crashed into the harbor off of Baltimore. She got out and sat on the wing of the plane until they came and rescued her, but it was one of those redliners that was going to the boneyard up in somewhere in Maryland.
Probably.
And, yeah.
Well, you have.
I do not remember that any of the 38 who died actually was ferrying one of those planes. I if they were, I've missed it somewhere. But yes, it was harrying. Because these things happen in midair. They didn't have things. Okay, one was ferrying, and gas fumes were coming in the cockpit. So she had to fly with the canopy wide open, and she couldn't see because there was stuff on the windshield. So she ended up landing the plane by hanging out the window and doing eyeballing the runway as she came in. And that was one of the beat up airplanes.
You had one woman who was a pilot who just disappeared into thin air. They never found her.
They still haven't. and they're still looking for her. She took off in a P-51 out of what is now LAX, Minesfield. And what they did, they were taking these P-51s all the way across the country to Newark. And most of them were manufactured out in the L.A. basin. And a whole slew of WASP, 7 or 8 WASP, and maybe 20 guys would end up in L.A. ready to fly 30-something P-51s that had come off the assembly line, and they were to fly those back to Newark. And in good weather, they could do that. It was a couple of days. They could fly only during daylight. But what happened to Gertrude Tompkins Silver was she took off in the P-51 and was never seen again. Now, the thing is, out there in L.A. at that point, there is fog and murk and gray stuff lying off the coast. Well, in a P-51, well, any of those, the fighter-type airplanes, anything with instruments, you can take off into stuff like that because you're going up, and they know that the ceiling is maybe 1,000 feet up. So once you get past that that ceiling, you're in blue sky. And most of the women, or most of the pilots, excuse me, are able to do that. They do not know what happened to Gertrude, whether she looked down and got vertigo, which is quite possible, or if she never made the turn. You had to do a 180 coming out of Mines Field. You went out over the ocean, over the Pacific, and took a 180 and turned back and then went east. They do not know. They think she went in the ocean, but they have looked for that plane for 70 years. Others think she made the turn and was coming back and crashed in the mountains east of L.A.
My.
They have been looking for her there. They've never found her. Mm. Yes.
The book is WASP of the Ferry Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds. Sarah Byrne Rickman wrote it. It's the third book in her trilogy about WASP, which the program ended in December of 1944. Yes. And this was pretty terrible, wasn't it? Tell us a little bit about how it ended and how sad it was.
Well, as I said, the militarization did not go through that previous summer. So Cochran tried to get Arnold to go ahead and militarize them anyway, and he couldn't do it. As I said, they were not paying for the WASP anymore. They had quit recruiting any more girls at that point, so they were no longer building the number. But basically what she told them, if you cannot give them some of these military benefits, you know, just shut them down. Nobody knows whether she was just, you know, playing hardball and taking a chance, but what happened is he did shut them down. But the reason he did it is, again, this thing about the war was changing. By late summer of 1944, we had gone well inland in France. D-Day was 2 or 3 months behind them. We had retaken Paris, and we were, at least to the generals, we were obviously winning the war, and they were beginning to pull back. They no longer needed the additional pilots, and they needed to bring the men who were coming back from their duty and flying combat were being brought home, and they needed to put them to work.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of keeping the women, and by this point we're talking about 1,000 women taking flying jobs, yes, and they wanted to send the women home and let the men have the jobs that the women had been doing. So that part of it is, it's tragic, it's sad, it was expedient, and from the general's point of view, you have to understand that this was the expedient thing to do. But they let the women go. It was very unceremonious. It was the girls said it was like we were being patted on the head and told, you were good girls, you did your job when we needed you, now you can go home, go back to the kitchen,
Go back and wash babies. Some dishes.
Yeah, wash dishes, have babies, go back to doing the women's stuff.
Public opinion had changed. Didn't they
absolutely.
Have the American Legion was against them, weren't they?
Yes. Public opinion had changed because the men were coming back, well, not unscathed, but they were coming back from combat. They needed those jobs. We no longer needed to train any more male pilots. Arnold figured we had enough. They were still at that point looking at Japan, and they were already beginning to put together an invasion of Japan. That, of course, ended with the atomic bomb. But by that time, the Wasp had gone for 6 months. The disbanding or the dismissal of the Wasp was probably expedient. It probably made sense. It could have been done so much gentler and given them some credit for what they did. Mm-hmm. They were basically told, I said, you were good girls, you did what we needed, now go home.
Mm-hmm.
And that, the Wasp carried a black feeling. They were pretty depressed afterwards. Most of them got over it. People do.
But it was not very
good treatment.
It had to have been particularly stinging when it was announced by the Air Force that they were finally going to allow women to fly airplanes.
Oh,
you remember that?
Early 70s?
Right.
Yeah. What had happened is that Cochran, again, she told Arnold, when I say told, her idea was that really maybe women didn't belong in the military flying aircraft. And they did it when they were really, really, really needed, but that it wasn't going to be a good idea to keep women in the military, and particularly flying airplanes. And she convinced Arnold to just put women out of the cockpits, and he did. He said no after December 20th, 1944. No women will fly military aircraft. That lasted for 33 years. And when the young women back in the 70s began to get into the military cockpits, and that was because of the Title IX movement and the women's movement back in the late 60s, early 70s, that brought all that about. But women were still not allowed in the cockpits at that point. Well, as that began to change, there was a story in the newspaper saying, first women to fly military aircraft for the United States. And the Wasp, who by that time are grandmothers and professional women and, doing all the things that grandmothers were in the 70s or a little bit older women. And they said, wait a minute.
Oh.
We were first.
That's terrible.
And that's really when the movement to get themselves militarized began.
My.
Yeah.
My guest is Sarah Byrne Rickman. Her book is Wasp of the Fairy Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds. We have just enough time to cover a couple of things that I think are important to cover. And one is, how did you become so completely absorbed in the story of Wasp? And number two, tell us about your connection to Dayton, Ohio.
Well, they go together.
Right.
I spent 36 years in Centerville, just moved 2 years ago. And while I was in Centerville, I was the editor of the Centerville Bellbrook Times, 1985 to 1989, and a museum, a small museum, opened up called the International Women's Air and Space Museum. And some Daytonians, I know Centervillians will remember it. It was there for about 10 years. But they opened up, and while I was the editor of the newspaper, I got to play the story, and I had always been interested in aviation. I was one of the girls who thought Amelia Earhart was phenomenal, and I wanted to fly. So I gravitated very naturally to that museum and got to be friends with them. Met my first Wasp, Nadine Nagel, who lives in Kettering. She is 97, and she is still with us. And I'm coming back to Dayton in 2 weeks, so I'm going to get to see her and a lot of my old friends there.
Okay.
I'm coming to the Air Force Museum, or to the National Aviation Hall of Fame enshrinement banquet, to work with a program that they put on for young high school girls called WOW, Women with Wings of Women. And that's on Friday, September 30th. and then the enshrinement of the Hall of Fame admittees is on Saturday. And the Hall of Fame does this every year for the young women of the Dayton area, the high school age kids, to learn about women in aviation. Betty Darst, a very good friend of mine, is responsible for putting that on for the Aviation Hall of Fame. And I'm coming back because several years ago I received a grant from the National Aviation Hall of Fame called the Combs Gates Award to write this book, mm-hmm. write The Wasp of the Fairey Command. And it is done. It is published, and I'm coming back to say, hey, guys, thank you. This is the result of what you gave me. I'm also doing a couple of things out in Centerville. I've got a book signing at the library, Centerville Library, where I served on the board for 18 years. And I'm taking part in a founders get-together in which we're honoring two of our Centerville women who have promoted the history of Centerville, Janet Tobabin and Celia Elliott. And I'll be introducing Celia at a reception Thursday night.
The Centerville connection, Washington Township connection, is very strong with Sarah uh-huh. Byrne Rickman. And I
absolutely.
Before we run into these last few moments here, I would like to mention that a gentleman who I consider to be Mr. Centerville Washington Township, Bob Daly.
Oh, is, I worked for Bob.
Yeah, he's
worked for him and with him, and he's a great friend.
He's guy said you've got to talk to Sarah Byrne Rickman again about her new book, Wasp of the Fairey Command: Women Pilots, yep. Uncommon Deeds. And Bob is an amazing man.
Yes, he is. He and I are fellow journalists. I put him at the top, we got to be friends at the Kettering Foundation, mm-hmm. and he's the tops. You are correct.
Yeah, he really is. Well, Sarah, are there any other books in the offing for you, any other projects now that you've run the Wasp story in through the trilogy?
Well, there is one more Wasp book that has just come out first of this month. It is Finding Dorothy Scott, Letters of a Wasp Pilot.
This is Dottie who died in the...
Yes,
yeah,
she is one of the 38 who died during the war.
Uh-huh.
She was one of the original 28, and her letters, her twin brother saved her letters home back in that year she served, and I have used those to write her biography. And that book just came out, and I will have that at the library as well as Wasp of the Fairey Command.
You are busy.
Yeah. I wrote the two of them at the, kind of one after together over the last 7 or 8 years. I would work on one and then go to the other while the other one was being read. So, yeah.
And is that also published by the UNT Press?
No, UNTP did publish my Nancy Love biography back in 08, but Finding Dorothy Scott is published by Texas Tech University Press in Lubbock.
Gotcha. Well, Sarah, it's really been a pleasure having you back on the program.
Hey, it's been marvelous. I am thrilled, delighted. I love to talk about the Wasp, obviously.
My guest has been Sarah Byrne Rickman. Her book is Wasp of the Fairey Command, Women Pilots, Uncommon Deeds. And she has joined us by telephone from Denton, Texas, where she's talking to us from Texas Woman's University, which we need to note is where they have a vast Wasp archive. You have all these wonderful photos in your book, and so many of them are from that archive.
Yes.
And you're there right now.
Yes, yes.
So
I'm here doing a little bit of research, and the staff from the library and I are going to Fredericksburg, Texas tomorrow night, tomorrow, and Saturday I am talking to a group at the Nimitz World War II Museum in Fredericksburg about the Wasp of the Fairey Command.
All right. Well, we'll see you in Dayton very soon, Sarah. Thanks again.
Vic, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You've been
listening. Hey to Dayton.
You betcha. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.